Jessica Fletcher.
Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get love in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge with a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning. This is MJ Network, and I am your host, Fran Lewis, and it is beautiful outside, and someday we won't have to wear a mask when we walk outside so we can actually say hello. But this is going to be fun because Jessica Fletcher is back, and the one and only John Land is here, and Jessica is going to really need her sleuthing because she's going to be on her own to try to solve Murder of 12. Hi, how you doing?
I'm good, you know. Being the life of a writer doesn't change too much in a pandemic. We're the lucky crowd. Of course, book sales have not exactly been boosted by this. So, you know, bookstores struggling, Amazon not delivering books. So we're
That's
in an
true.
Interesting time.
Yeah, I know. I was lucky that one of the authors, Alan Topol, sent me a copy of his book, and it took like until 2 weeks to get here. So what I did was I told Amazon, like, move it, and they sent me an extra copy because I'm a VIP, they said. So now I have two. I read the book yesterday. I literally sat down and read it yesterday because I have to interview him next week. And Dick Belsky's book didn't get here yet. And Dick said that the company sent it. The post office is just not delivering anything. It's really weird. I mean, they're just saying they're holding it in the post office, in the office, but they're not delivering, so I have to cut on the phone with USPS Leo later and see why I'm not getting some books that are actually been sent. Oh, well, what could you do? I'm going to need Jessica to fix this one for me, maybe. So, this one was interesting. The novel starts with a scene that sets off a chain of events. How did you get her to go? Well, it started with a signing, but before that, she goes to with Mort, and they find these people in cars. How did you create that? That was scary.
Well, you have to. I knew in this book, everything was building toward the setup, very much like, and then there were none. The classic Agatha Christie, the Agatha Christie classic, arguably the most famous mystery of all time, if not the best. And I wanted to do a Murder, She Wrote version of that. So I already had Jessica living in the local hotel because her house was damaged in a fire. So as soon as I did that, I started to think about how I could do something. When we spoke a few months ago about A Time for Murder, I wrote that book, number 50 in the series, because no one had ever, either in the TV show or the book series, introduced Jessica as a younger woman. Again, I wanted to do something that had never been done before, nor in the history of the book series had they ever done anything like the locked room murder, where a bunch of strangers are isolated together, stranded together, and begin to get knocked off one at a time. But here's the thing. When you, being a thriller writer, I understand that suspense is not generated by having people stuck in a blizzard. The suspense is generated by waking up and the snow is just starting to fall, and we watch it piling up. So we ratchet up the suspense. So the scene, the opening scene you're referring to, was necessary because I didn't want to start the book and write the entire book set within a single setting. I wanted to set up what was going to happen later. So Jessica and Mort are called to the scene on the grounds of an old mill, which is what, you know, in my lexicon, Cabot Cove was a mill and factory town hundreds of years ago. they're called there, or Mort's called there, and Jessica accompanies him because of an apparent suicide. Well, of course, Jessica mm-hmm. notices kind of shiny areas of the seat cushions, where she deduces, as is Jessica's custom, that the man was duct taped to the seat while carbon monoxide killed him. So right away we know we've got a murder. And from there, the question becomes, how is this murder of a man who turns out to be a private detective from Boston? What is he doing in Cabot Cove, Maine, on the eve of a killer blizzard? And what does that have to do with these two wedding parties that have gathered in Hill House, mm-hmm. six people in each, murder of 12, who then systematically are being killed one at a time?
I was worried that Jessica had to watch out because, you know, I can understand people being afraid of the snow, because when I was teaching 1 year, there was like 22 inches of snow, and I walked to school and I got stuck praying to get back because the blizzard got worse and they didn't close the schools back then. So
are they
crazy?
They didn't close the schools?
They never closed the schools back then. When I started to work, they still don't that often. There was 22 inches of snow, and the Mayor Koch opened the schools, and I walked there with somebody. And it was like 25, whatever it was. It's like a 25, 30-minute walk to work, and I prayed to God I didn't fall and kill myself. On the way back, my principal said, well, because you live like 10 minutes away, we need you to stay with the kids who are left. I said, and you get to drive me home. Because I wasn't taking, there was no bus, there's no train. I said, how am I going to walk, get there? And I made him drive into the parking lot. It took me a half an hour to walk from the edge of the parking lot into the building. That's how deep the snow was. So I feel sorry for Jessica and Kendall.
She's doing just fine, don't worry.
What could I say? So Jessica starts to seem, and she meets Constance. And she wants her to sign her book, whatever. So she decides that she's going to become friends with her. Why are they so concerned at this dinner, at this rehearsal dinner? What happens there?
Well,
and who are the guests? They were the guests. I mean, I felt like I was in the middle of a battle with these people. They don't like each other.
The genius of exactly. It was kind of it's kind of the Murder, She Wrote version of the Eugene O'Neill play,
yeah.
Long Day's Journey into Night. You've got these warring factions of two different families, each with his own or her own secret. Each is a suspect. And the thing about, and then the genius of the Agatha Christie classic, And Then There Were None, lies in the fact that the murders are often committed in either plain sight or close to plain sight. And the genius of that lie was rooted in the fact that all the killings tied into the famous nursery rhyme that gave the script, the book its early name, another name it's known by, which is Ten Little Indians. And Then There Were None, of course, is the last line of the nursery rhyme. So the idea that 12 people could be in the same room and that the first attempted murder, or murder as it may be, takes place right in front of everyone else. Right away from the start, what you achieve as a writer, as Jessica and I were doing, is you put everyone in imminent danger. Because clearly who's ever doing the killing doesn't care about, is so fiendish and so cunning and so ingenious that they're going to be able to kill these 12 people no matter what it is they do, whatever precautions they take. But it's a good the one thing the killer was not anticipating was the presence of Jessica Fletcher. And we've seen that before. What this, for fans of the TV series, and let's face it, Fran, you've heard me say on this show before, when I took this series over, I generally ignored the previous 46 books because the ones I read, I did not feel captured the television series adequately or appropriately. Why? Because my predecessor, who was a immensely talented and successful writer, Don Bain, had never watched the show. So he wasn't familiar with the Jessica Fletcher. So he created a different Jessica Fletcher. And that's undeniable. Regardless of how you feel about what I'm doing and how you felt about what Don did in his 46 books, which is an incredible accomplishment, by the way, 46 books in one series, 23 years, two books a year for 23 years. It's amazing. But when I took over, I made a conscious decision to go back to the TV series and ask myself, if this series were being made today, what would it look like? So when I go back to the TV series, which is where I got my inspiration, because that's how I knew Murder, She Wrote, not knowing the books. One of my favorite episodes, if not my favorite episode, is number 16 from season 1. I think it's number 16. Murder Takes the Bus, where Jessica and the former sheriff, Amos Tupper, played so brilliantly by Tom Bosley, are stranded by a storm and the washing out of the roads at a roadside diner. 10 strangers trapped inside a diner, and now one of them dies. And then what happens to the other ones? Another is attacked. So to me, what writing The Murder of 12 allowed me to pay homage not only to And Then There Were None, arguably the most famous mystery of all time, but it also allowed me to salute and pay homage to Murder Takes the Bus, which was one of the great episodes ever on that classic TV series. So that's the basic set piece. And you're absolutely right. The warring factions of these two families, it's like a soap opera. You know, a soap opera with murder. You know, right from the start, and just to give a little bit away, when Jessica realizes the fraternal twins, one who's getting married, one who's the best man, the fraternal twins, she spots in a slideshow, which, you know, which is being projected against a wall through much of the dinner, that there's a third crib in their nursery. Well, if there's only two twins, who was supposed to be in the third crib? So right away, I'm planting seeds. I'm starting to water the ground. The difference with Murder of 12, and here was the challenge, and this is a great point. The other five books I've written in the series, and I include the one that's coming out in December, all took place over the course of between 5 and 7 days, where Jessica has a lot of time to research, a lot of time to probe, a lot of time to investigate. But Murder of 12 unfolds in a single day, almost all of it within a 12-hour period between 3 p.m. and 3 a.m. From the time Jessica gets back to Hill House and the time the book finally comes to its conclusion. So it's an entirely different set of challenges. Why is this important? Because when you've done a series that has 50 books in it, where you're doing two a year, how do you keep the reader from getting bored? How do you keep the reader coming back? And you do that by continually presenting material that the reader has not seen in any book before. So they're always getting something fresh. So they're always getting something original, as opposed to rewriting the same book over and over and over again, which you see too much these days, especially in cozy mysteries.
That is very, very true. And you know how many cozy mysteries I read? Too many.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, and I never, you know, my rule is never to write anything that's negative. And a specific publicist sent me a book, and I read it, and I said, I'm not going to review this because I disagree with, it was a self-help book. I said, I disagree with everything he said, and I don't believe that that could really happen. I said, some of what he's writing is true, and some of what he's writing, if you live where I do, you can't do it. So I wrote something, not nasty, just, you know, I said, this is really good, but I would do it this way, I disagree. And they don't want me to post it.
Well, you know, you're raising an excellent point.
You know, too bad.
You're raising an excellent point. And the fact is, I know there's a lot of writers and hardcore readers
who listen to your show. And mm-hmm. What you experience with that self-published book is the bane of so many self-published books. They're not edited well. Anybody can write a book, but not
anybody
can write a good book. And even if you can write a good book, I mean, I've written over 50 books, Fran, and I still need editors as much as I've ever needed editors.
Yeah.
The Murder, She Wrote books, and I've had three different editors at Berkeley on Murder, She Wrote, and all of them have been outstanding at keeping me disciplined, at not letting me go off the rails entirely and revert to my nature and instincts, which as a thriller writer is to continually drive the plot. You see, here's the thing, and this goes to definitions. What is a cozy? What is a regular mystery? What is a crime thriller? All these things are reasonable questions, but none of them matter if the story is not being propelled forward, if there's nothing happening, if there are no cliffhangers, if there are no murders or only one murder, and it's, you don't even know it's a murder, and it takes place as the secondary plot as opposed to the primary plot. If you go back to the TV series, and this is what really irks me, the TV series was full of cliffhangers. The TV series was full of suspense. The TV series was one of the best written TV series in history. So to tell me that my books are, there's too much going on, there are too many cliffhangers, that's not the way cozies are written. Well, when Murder, She Wrote came on the air, the term cozy mystery had not yet been invented. So I'm kind of tired of labels. I'm kind of like, you know what? What makes it a cozy is, to me, and I'm just going to give you my definition. What makes Murder, She Wrote a cozy series is a familiarity with Cabot Cove. You're coming to a place you know very well. And you're meeting old friends, these characters, Dr. Seth Hazlitt, Sheriff Mort Metzger, Private Detective Harry McGraw. And what I try to do, or what I will be trying to do or doing, at least in the next book, is sprinkling in other characters from the TV series. And I think, and that brings back what it solidifies Murder, She Wrote's place as frozen in time. Which is ironic to say frozen in time, given that Murder of 12 takes place in a killer blizzard. But it's frozen in time in that the characters don't age. Even though I've updated the series to include Uber and Grubhub and cell phones and technology, all the characters are still the same. Cabot Cove is not the same. What you have, and I've never said it this way, the environment changes. Characters cannot control the passage of time and their environments. But that doesn't mean the characters have to change. One of the things I'm doing now, that one of the mistakes I made when I first took over the series, and everybody makes mistakes, except, of course, Donald Trump, but we won't go there.
Right. Oh, yes,
he's
perfect.
No, never makes a mistake. But the mistake I made in trying to stay true to the TV show was, okay, you know, back in those days, Mort Metzger never called Jessica anything but Mrs. F. Occasionally, Mrs. Fletcher. But I said, you know what? It's a different era. We're more familial today. We're more colloquial today. He would be calling her Jessica. And maybe that's true. But I broke a rule. And I took readers out of their comfort zone. And that was wrong. That was a mistake. That was part of the learning experience. Fran, when you take over an iconic series like Murder, She Wrote, it doesn't come with an owner's manual. Nobody handed me a manual and thank God they didn't, because I wouldn't have listened to it anyway. No one said,
right.
This is how you write a Murder, She Wrote book. This is how you write a cozy mystery. No. To Berkeley's credit, they let me find my way and take ownership of the series and create a hybrid using the structure and format of the cozy mystery, but adding elements of suspense, danger, and cliffhangers. Now, some people would call that upsetting the apple cart. I call that going back to the spirit of the TV show, because everything I'm doing in my books is consistent with the Jessica Fletcher, who was the TV hero, not necessarily the Jessica Fletcher who appeared in the books before I took over the series.
Yeah, well, I'll have to tell you, Jessica Fletcher and Mort are pretty much different. The one that I find that's pretty the same is Seth, though. He's still the
yes.
old-fashioned doctor. He still has his old-fashioned office, and I doubt if he really cares about having any old-fashioned fancy machinery there. He reminds me of my doctor when I was little, just yesterday. Didn't he refuse to have an X-ray machine? He believed in the ridiculous fluoroscope thing, and in 5 minutes he knew what was wrong with you. That's Seth. Anyway, the mother of the groom and we don't know who the bride's parents are, but the father doesn't like Constance, and his daughter is marrying her son. That doesn't like. Oh well, they don't like each other, do they? This is
long day's journey into
so
night.
Sad. Well, we've got. She calls Harry McGraw. And I can picture his face, the Harry, so sad that he's not here anymore, who uncovers just who the victim was and what he did. So how does this link to Constance Mulroy and the Doyle and the bride's father, this Loomis guy?
Well, it's a great question. And the private detective was a forensics specialist, financial
yeah.
forensics. So we know at that point it's something about money. And we know that Constance Mulroy's husband was a Bernie Madoff-like con man who swindled investors out of millions and millions of dollars, one of whom is going to be her soon-to-be in-law, the father of the bride, and she's the mother of the groom. So you have this unusual family dynamic. Oh, and by the way, the husband committed suicide by jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge. Well, whenever you hear suicide and the body wasn't recovered, now we add another potential suspect. You know, when I introduce a character who walks on crutches, the cane crutches, readers are probably thinking right away that maybe that's a ruse. Maybe those crutches really aren't needed. So the fun of this book, and this is where when you get into the dynamics of it, everybody has an agenda. Everybody has something they're trying to hide. And the problem with the traditional cozy, you know, the ones that where very little happens, is you have exceptionally little conflict. And conflict is the driver of all great stories. William Faulkner said, the greatest conflict is the human heart at war with itself. And that's what he based all his books on, the human heart at war with itself. So when the real thing that I brought to the series and what you're going to see in The Murder of 12 is every page, every paragraph, every scene has a definable conflict which drives the story forward. The story is the car. The conflict is the engine that drives the car, that pushes the car forward. The characters are the gasoline. This is storytelling 101. And what I want to do, and I think I may have done it, or what I hope I've done it with The Murder of 12. What I set out to do with The Murder of 12 is create a book that had to be read in a single sitting. That once started, it was impossible. I mean, literally, because you're living in that blizzard. You're watching the snow pile up outside. The irony, of course, is that the book is coming out as the weather is getting warmer. So, and I actually think that probably adds to it. People forget, Miracle on 34th Street was not released at Christmas time. Neither was It's a Wonderful Life. So in the old days, you didn't necessarily release movies with a Christmas theme at Christmas time. Now you definitely would. Whereas with this book, I think it's kind of fun. And of course, here's the other thing. We started off our conversation by talking a little bit about the pandemic. I don't know if The Murder of 12 would have been as relatable as it is now because people know what it's like to be stranded. They know what it's like not to be able to leave their homes, metaphorically anyway. Obviously, there's no blizzard outside, but there's a killer virus outside. So in some places, there are people who have not left their homes. Literally, there are people who haven't left their homes in 73 or 74 days in New York. And this, so the idea of reading a claustrophobic murder mystery in the midst of something that has turned us all into claustrophobes, you know, is something else. You know, timing is everything. So I kind of think that The Murder of 12 is the perfectly timed book for what we're going through now. And I, you know, it's what I think about, did I realize what I set out to do? Because that's how a writer judges the how they manage, how they dealt with a book. Is a book, in my mind, really good? If I accomplished everything I set out to do, and you never know if you can do that before you start, in my case, because I don't outline. I just go by the seat of my pants. I would say that everything I imagined Murder of 12 could be is realized in the book that – and by the way, today is publication day. So this is the first day you can get it unless you order it on Amazon, in which case God knows when you're going to get it because they're not shipping books anymore or not telling you when they are going to ship books. Or when you're going
to
get
it. Well, you'll
it,
be
so.
Very happy to know that Amazon loves me today because I put your review out. I was the first one to review it this morning.
Oh,
and they accepted it.
Thank you.
Yes, the stars
you,
are shining. They are shining. The review is on LinkedIn, Facebook, and everywhere else I could think of. I'm going to put it on all the groups later because I belong to too many and they love it. But I said, I got up at 6 o'clock today, and I said, okay, I'm going to have my 97th cup of coffee, but first I'm going to put the review out. Then I read it over. Then I corrected my mistakes because I'm typing with 8.5 fingers. I wanted
That's
to
right.
make sure.
Poor Fran.
Yeah, oh, this is hilarious. Yeah, that was a splint on my left thumb. It looks really pretty. I can't wait to get it off next Monday, but I have a funny feeling that my thumb is still broken. Oh, well, what can you do? It doesn't love me. But anyway, so I posted it this morning. I was so proud of myself. I said, okay, good, I'm going to do this now. So that was good. And when you talk about confinement, everybody just know that because of John, I wrote this. My next book is called What If? What if you lived in a world that I created? Would you be happy in the one that you're confined in now? That's all I'm going to say.
Ah.
It's more like the Twilight Zone. It's not a Faces Behind the Stone series. And one of the stories is actually called Confinement. It's about a lady that hoards everything, gets everybody to bring her stuff. They're not allowed to come in her house. She has ways of getting her food. But what happens at the end when she tries to leave is right out of the Twilight Zone. I don't know how I did it, but I have 12 people reading it that I don't even know who they are, and hopefully somebody will like it and give me some blurbs. What can I say? But it's called What If. So Seth is worried about Jessica because Mort has to deal with snowplows, and Mort has enough problems after that too because we don't trust these people anymore. So he's worried about her being alone during the rehearsal dinner when it turns deadly. So how does she proceed to help? And he can only help her a little bit.
You see,
I love Seth. You have to know he's my favorite character. Sorry. I like
and,
him.
And William Wyndham played him so brilliantly in the series. We just
yeah,
lost
he
William
was.
Wyndham
he was
died
great.
Last year.
I know.
Yeah. He was a solid actor, and that was the role that came to define him. Played it for 14 years or 13 years. But here you're getting at the essence of the challenge of writing The Murder of 12, which was this. Jessica is used to interacting. She is, you know, she works with a detective. In New York, it was Artie Gelber. You know, it was Amos Tupper. Now it's Mort Mesker. She has people who will help her, who will protect her, you know, who will come to her when she's in need. The challenge of The Murder of 12 is nobody can get there. So I have to do everything on the cell phone until the service dies. So when Constance Mulroy, the matriarch of one side of the family, keels over at the table. We later learn she was poisoned. Jessica calls Seth Hazlitt and plays doctor doing what Seth Hazlitt advises her to do. then she's on the phone with Mort. She's on the phone with Harry. So this is the challenge of doing a book where the people aren't there physically. But at that stage of the story, we're still building the story. We're still building in the sense that the suspense is starting to really ramp up. It's starting to ratchet up. So we're starting to realize that there's a killer among us, because at that point, we're not sure. And then as the snow continues to pile up, Mort tries to get there by snowmobile, never shows up. Harry's in New York. Seth's trapped at his house. The Volvo is covered in snow. The old Volvo can't get there. So Jessica is on her own. There's no one to help her. So she does rely a little bit on and this is fun, the owner of Hill House, or the part owner and general manager of Hill House, Seamus McGillray, who was a constable, a traffic constable in Ireland, becomes her co-detective. Because you've got to have the sidekick. You've got to have Jessica. You've got to give Jessica someone to play off of. Because if you don't, everything is internal monologue. Everything is happening in her head.
Yeah.
And, you don't have those witty exchanges of dialogue. And you don't allow other characters to come forward. And because in a whodunit, remember, the killer could be anybody from the young front desk clerk to the hulking temp kitchen worker, Eugene. We don't know who the killer is. Everybody is a suspect that you meet. Everyone. There are so many red herrings in this story. So many timelines of people. Where were you in these 20 minutes? And I even throw in, I had so much fun with this, the locked room murder, where one of the murders takes place. There's a struggle going on inside a bedroom section of a suite, and the door is locked. And finally, Eugene, the big hulking kitchen worker who's a temp, breaks it down. And there's a dead body in the room. Where's the killer? They didn't go out the window. What happened? So not only do we have the classic setup of 12 strangers being killed one at a time when they're stranded at a hotel, we've got one of them being killed in the classic lockroom murder. But the clues are all there. And if you pay attention to that murder, you'll know who the killer is. That's the fun
of
the murder of 12. You're playing along interactively with Jessica. The great thing about writing these books in first person, because I don't like first person, but the great thing about writing Murder, She Wrote in first person is the books take place in real time, in Jessica's timeline. You know everything Jessica knows. You see everything Jessica sees. In this book, you are as capable of solving the murder as Jessica is. When she realizes who the killer is in that penultimate moment, when they're all taking refuge in her suite, the ones that are still alive, and they know they're going to be dead by dawn if they don't find the killer, that's when Jessica finally comes upon who the killer, confirms her suspicions of who the killer is. And boy, was that fun.
That was fun. So we have Seamus, but now, let's see, we're going to kill off the ex-wife. We kill off Doyle, but I don't like him anyway, so that doesn't really matter that he's dead.
You're not supposed to
I didn't really care. I didn't really care about him. So then we have an interesting thing, because they were told not to leave. They said to stay there. So what happens when one couple wants to leave? How you stop them, and why do they seem not to really care? Because they left anyway.
Well,
but then it's not safe to go anywhere. I wouldn't go anywhere in this snow, but then again, you don't know who's out there to kill you.
The key thing in a murder in this kind of murder mystery is to introduce characters that nobody else knows. So who are they really? And these two young people, who are friends of the bride and groom, nobody else knows them, or maybe peripherally, and they have a different attitude. Now, the reason for that is what I said before. If you take 12 people and put them in a hotel, if they're all the same, if none of them, if they're all rich, if they're all snobby, if they're all this, if they're all that, well, that's not fun. There's no distinction between the characters. Friend, you know, what what people are going to notice, I did something in this book that I've never done before in fiction. I put in a cast of characters because it's important
that the
reader can go back to that just to refresh their memory as to who these people are and what their connection to each other is. That's important because they're each distinct. They're each their own person. But none of them have a lot of screen time because I have to develop so many. That was the real challenge of this book. You know, not only does it take – I have a book that takes place in 12 – that essentially takes place in one day. And then the huge portion of it takes place in 12 hours. That's not a lot of time to develop characters and for Jessica to get to know any. So you have to cheat a little bit by making everyone distinctive in a very dramatic way. For instance, the bride, the would-be bride's brother, uses a universal key card to enter Jessica's suite, not realizing that she's inside. So you have a ne'er-do-well criminal who's on the premises. Well, if he's a thief, maybe he's also a killer. He doesn't have, and then of course you get into the fact that he has a bad relationship with his father. So when his father becomes a victim, maybe he's the killer. This is the fun of the book. It's injecting enough doubt and enough suspicion about each character. And of course, what Chris, the other book that this has been compared to somewhat is Murder on the Orient Express, which, spoiler alert, the idea is they all did it, but it's pretty much a cliche now. So it's really much more like And Then There Were None, because I don't cop out in the end. I give you the killer you were hoping for, in the sense that it gets a little gothic, it gets a little little out there, but I think there's a logic to the identity of the killer, why he's doing or she's doing what they're doing, because maybe there's more than one. Because that's the other thing about books like this. Sometimes we forget it could be more than one killer. And was there someone who died who wasn't properly examined, so maybe their death was faked? This is the fun of this kind of book. However more books I write, I don't think I'll ever write a book that was as much fun to write and as much fun to read as The Murder of 12.
This was really my favorite, and you're right, I read it in 2 hours. Seriously.
Wow.
Yes, I did. I just sat down and read it. Then I said, I better take a motion because my eyes are going to bother me.
I did.
I read it. And just so you know that I was strong from the heart, I started that yesterday. And I'm very proud of myself. I'm almost done with 900 pages of I Know This Much Is True by Wally Lamb. I read 500. It's hard. I'm reading it, and then I'm reading commentaries about it because I want to make sure that I get it right. And I started to write a review, and it's like too many words already, and I haven't finished the book. But I do know how it ends, and it's like mental illness all the way. This is really like 900 pages of, oh, my God.
You know,
but
it's
anyway.
Interesting. You raise how long it took you to read, and this book is only about 67,000-68,000 words, about 5,000 less than my other books in the series. My Caitlin Strong books are about 105,000 words. Now that's a difference of almost 40,000 words. The interesting thing is that if you add up the screen time, Jessica is in all 68,000 words because the book is first person. But because of the Caitlin Strong books, I'm cutting from one subplot to another. Of those 105,000, Caitlin is probably only in around half the book, about 52,000 of those pages involve Caitlin. So Jessica, in these shorter books, actually gets more screen time than Caitlin Strong, the Texas Ranger, who's the hero of my primary of the series that I've been writing. The 11th book will be coming up. That's the one you just started, Strong from the Heart. So that's the nature of writing first person. The Jessica, now remember, Murder, She Wrote on television was obviously not first person. There were numerous episodes where Jessica plays a much smaller role. So I, when people ask me what's the biggest difference between the books and the TV show, of at least my books, it's the fact that Jessica is in every single scene because of the first-person nature. There is much more pressure on Jessica as a character in the books because there's no diversions from her thinking. You're in her head. You were in her head for the whole 2 hours it took you to read the book. And by the way, the great thing about a book this length is what you just said. People who are fast readers can read it in the same amount of time it takes them to watch a movie. Or even if you're a little slower like me, it might be a long movie or kind of like two-hour episodes of a streaming series, you know. Because, and that's the great thing. You live with these characters for brief periods of time, but that keeps you wanting more. It keeps you coming back.
This is true, but to be very honest, if a book is like 300-400 pages and it takes me longer than 2-3 hours to read it, you're in trouble. No, seriously.
Unless it's a Caitlin Strong book.
The Caitlin Strong book, I take my time, and the first chapter was Oh God, and with Camino Pass, and then she goes to the school, and then
I love that scene.
And then the scene at the school is my favorite. Let me tell you, that was really good.
That's a great scene.
That is a great scene.
And we'll bait that hook and talk about it in July.
Yeah.
Well, August. I think, what can I say?
Okay, so let me see.
I don't know. Have we booked our next interview for that book yet? I forgot if we have, but
we do. August 12th.
We already did. Yep.
Okay.
There you go.
Before I forget, and they yell at me, whatever. No. Thursday. This is going to be a trip and a half. I've got 5 authors, and we're going to do a panel show on who's your killer, how does your killer decide he's going to kill, and how's he going to go about killing them. That's just some of it. And we've got Charles Salzberg, R.G. Belsky, Tom Walsh, Devin Goodwin, and Bruce Coffin. Seriously. This is going to be hilarious. And then on the 3rd, we've got Alan Topol, The French Revenge. On the 8th, Jeff Bond. On the 10th, Salt the Snow. It's a true story about a true newspaper lady, newscaster, that was kind of weird during World War II. The 15th, we have an author, Emilio's Garden from Costa Rica. On the 17th, I'm praying to God that Orgy's book, Gelsia, the one he writes under Dana Perry, A Golden Girl, I haven't gotten it yet. On the 22nd, Enemy of the Doves. On the 24th, another panel. This was really brave. We can talk about voice, John. I know this should be interesting. And on the 29th, to end June, Pastor Michael Jones. We're going to talk about the pandemic and how to deal with stress and anxiety. Other than that, the show's booked till the end of October, sort of.
Very wow. Strong.
I don't know how I did it. Yeah. And I'm waiting. I just got an email from Tess Gerrington, and she wants me to hold the date in June of 2021, hopefully, when the next book comes out. Okay. So we've got 2 news reports that have to do with what happened at Hill House, and then that's one. And what is the significance of the tote bag? That's all I'm going to say about that.
One of the things that Jessica is – the fun of writing Jessica is she sees things – that nobody else can see.
Yeah.
She observes things. She's her powers of observation. So she notices in Constance Mulroy's room while she's watching over her because the woman has slipped into a coma.
Yeah.
That there's a matching set of luggage in the closet, but there's a gap. As if one of a smaller tote bag or smaller suitcase has been removed. What's inside that tote bag? And how does it relate to the fact that her in-law, the Doyle Castevet, how does it relate to the fact that he wants his money back that he was swindled out of by her husband? So that's just another plot point. What you do in a book like this, all the conflict has to be inside because you have nowhere else to go. So what I found myself doing was continually throwing more at the reader. The missing tote bag. And then we find the tote bag. And we see what's inside the tote bag. And there's nail polish on one of the handles. Of course, remember, we have no forensics in this story because there's no time to take fingerprints. All the staples of modern mysteries are removed in the murder of 12. No fingerprints, no crime scene units. It's only Jessica, her cell phone, and her powers of observation. But that means when you have a tote bag, you can't take fingerprints, you can't do DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, a lot of the fun in the murder of 12 lies, and you may feel that you may agree with this, in the fact that it's a throwback mystery. It's an old-fashioned mystery because technology, other than cell phones, does not play any role. Cell phones, for a number of reasons, as you started to allude to before, because the key thing for me, and no matter what I write, whether it be a thriller, a mystery, nonfiction, you must have a rising scale of stakes and of suspense. If suspense dwindles or flattens the book, you've lost the reader. So you keep the suspense going by continually throwing in complications. Think of the movie Jaws, the second half of the movie Jaws. They go out to hunt the shark, and then the shark is hunting them. In every scene, something else goes wrong on the boat. And the shark is starting to win. More and more, the boat, and then they realize the boat is sinking. Well, that is the classic format that I use in The Murder of 12. Because every time you think you can get comfortable and sit down, boom, something else happens. Another wrench gets thrown into the works. Something else is revealed. It's one revelation on top of another, and that's what makes it a potential one sitting read, which is what I wanted it to be.
And yeah, so several hands out to read it seriously, and there is someone that is going to get it. Otherwise, I don't get an appointment to see him.
I hope it's your hairdresser.
My hairdresser is being a pain, and it's not him because he's in the Bronx, and he told me what I have to do, but somebody's coming to do my hair tomorrow, somebody else, so that I don't look like such a mess all the time. No, actually, one of my doctors had the nurse call me and asked if I had any reading material. Otherwise, I can't come see him. That's hilarious.
Are you going to bring him the Murder of 12?
Yeah, I definitely am because he asked for it. He said, I've read a couple that you've given me, so he wants that. He wants Alan Topol's book. I think he's going to take The French Revenge. And he wants a few others that I just finished. So if he's lucky, I'll remember to bring all of them. I read some really good ones, but I read some really, I just finished Jeffrey Deva, The Goodbye Man.
Good book, good really, book, good book.
Oh, that was really good. And there's another one that was on Facebook, Erin Carr, Strung Out.
Don't know that.
That's a true story about her being on opiates. Really scary. But I have a whole bunch of them over there that I have for Dr. M, so he'll let me come next week to visit him. So we've got 10 more minutes. So this is really scary, really. Snow. I hate snow. I don't like ice. And the minute I see a flake, I hide. So how can snow block the vents and cause a chemical to kill them? And then poor Mort gets covered in snow. And what is she supposed to do? I mean, I get claustrophobia just thinking about this. How did you create that one? That's like,
well,
oh, my God.
It's fairly simple in the sense that if the vents plug up,
yeah.
You know, this can happen, and this happens tragically in homes every year. When you get a lot of snow and the snow piles up over, the air coming into the house, and that's how you can get carbon monoxide poisoning. So the fact the snow is plugging the vents means there's no air circulation from the outside, or you could put in whatever you wanted into the room. That's just a way of injecting a toxin into the air, because the vents are blocked. But, that's just another clever way the killer is able to wipe out people who now know he's there. Because what you're alluding to is this. It's one thing in a mystery to kill someone who's not expecting it, and then the rest of the story is about uncovering the identity of the murderer. It's a whole other thing when people are locked in their rooms knowing there's a killer among them. The challenge for the killer becomes astronomical. Because now there's no surprise. You've taken the element of surprise away. That forces the killer, whether it be, I won't mention who it was in And Then There Were None, or the killer in The Murder of 12, has to be fiendishly clever and also capable of distracting people, to getting them confused. That's the reason why you started to mention before, in the middle of the book, or when things are really ramping up during the blizzard, everyone gets a text on their cell phone at the same time. Something that I've added to Murder, She Wrote, as I mentioned before, technology. And the text is about a serial mass murderer who twice before has wiped out groups of people in a single setting. Every 2 years to the day, this is that day. So now Jessica has to confront the fact, and so does everyone in that hotel who's alive.
That's right.
That they may be stalked, they may all be dead by dawn, and the person doing it is doing it for fun. It's sport for them. And if that's the case, of course, Jessica's also in danger. She's at the hotel, which means she's a potential victim. But is that the reality, or is that a red herring? There really – and then it's, being someone who doesn't write an outline, I also was challenged by something else. Another part of the brilliance of And Then There Were None, the Agatha Christie classic that is the inspiration for The Murder of 12. Every time someone dies, one of 10 figurines disappears. They start with 10, and that's the other mystery. Who took the figurine? The killer took the figurine, but we were all in the room. How did they do it? When did they do it? I have an old grandfather clock that I wrote in a – I didn't do it in the first draft. I went back and added it because I realized I needed an effect like that. So now when they're gathered in the lobby shortly after getting that text message, the clock strikes midnight and everyone turns toward it, and the first two numerals have been crossed off. And then
that's
as more people are claimed as victims, more of the numerals are crossed off. The interesting thing is this. And Then There Were None, there are 10 murders. And the murder and Then There Were None is classified as a cozy. I get criticized, or I get questioned about how I've changed the quote cozy, and yet, And Then There Were None killed 10 people, as brutally as I ever do in these books, and that's considered a cozy. But I haven't killed 10 people in the book, all the books combined leading up to The Murder of 12. So I find it a little ironic. Of how of perception, of what makes a cozy. It isn't the body count. It's how the people are killed, but it's also the characters, the recurring characters you've come to know and love, who you want to see again like old friends during the holidays. And maybe because we're so disjointed now, maybe because we can't visit our friends, maybe because families couldn't spend Passover and Easter together, that when you read a book like this where you meet a bunch of people that you really like to see, Harry and Mort and Seth and Jessica, in this book you even meet Ethan Cragg, who's a fisherman friend played by Claude Akins, who never appeared in any of the books before this one. But in the first 12 episodes or so, He was Jessica's, he was Seth Hazlitt. He was her friend in town, you know, who she would do stuff with. William Wyndham didn't come into the TV series as Seth Hazlitt until, I think, halfway through the first season. I could be wrong. It might have been a little later, a little earlier. It might have even been the beginning of the second season. So you're all, so fans of the series are going to see the Claude Akins character, Ethan Cragg, in this book, which was a lot of fun to write his character because it had been so long since we'd seen him.
Well, I have a question before we end. Seriously?
Yes.
Are you going to bring Seamus back?
That's a very good question. No plans to now, but you never know in these kind of books. You might see him in you know, around town, but I think he was probably a one-off. Great character.
So,
great character, and he made a great foil for Jessica, standing in for everybody who can't get there.
This is very, very true. And poor Jessica, before the killer is found, she gets stuck outside in the snow, and I really got worried because that would never happen to me. I mean, I can't stand even dealing with the snow. No less, really, the good part about living up here is that they actually plow and they make the snow go away. When I lived in the Bronx, you were actually isolated and quarantined forever because they never plowed. And it was
good
like,
God.
So what is next for Jessica?
Well,
and
I wanted, again, I start
Caitlin.
Every book. I start every book in either series, especially Murder, She Wrote, asking myself what has never been done before. But I did want to do a Christmas theme title for the Christmas season. So I wrote one. The next one is called Murder in Season. What I wanted to do was I wanted to present a little alternative history of Cabot Cove, dealing with the slave trade and a lost fortune by the this mystery that goes all the way back to the founders. But most important from an emotional standpoint, in Murder in Season, Grady Fletcher, the nephew that Jessica raised, comes for Christmas with his wife. And for the first time ever in books or movies, we're going to meet Jessica's grandnephew, who's named after her late husband, Frank. And what makes
this series.
And if I continue it beyond Murder in Season, beyond Murder in Season, if I'm still writing it, I'll want to bring in more and more of the characters from the TV show. And can I give you a spoiler alert, an idea that I have? If Jessica is in Los Angeles, we're going to get her out of Cabot Cove if I do this book. And she's on the set of one of her books, J.B. Fletcher's books, which is being made into a streaming series for Netflix. And there's a murder on the set in Los Angeles. Who's the detective who comes to investigate the murder? Columbo.
Oh, God.
And Columbo, the classic mystery, was made by the same studio, NBC Universal. It had the same producers, William Link and Richard Levinson. So can
Columbo.
You imagine a pairing of the two greatest detectives, arguably, in television history? Can you imagine the conversations between Jessica and Lieutenant Columbo?
Could you imagine if she solves the murder and she doesn't and he doesn't?
Well, if I write, that's the challenge. When you bite off something that's too big to chew, Fran, you end up with a situation where which of them gets to solve the mystery? Because the answer is they both have to solve it together. If I write nothing else, I have to write the scene where Columbo goes, "Oh, Mrs. Fletcher, my wife loves your books. Could I get you to sign this copy?" You know, just picture Peter Falk in the old car, in the old raincoat. I mean, because if I do that, it's going to be the old Columbo. Same car, same raincoat. It's got to be. And by the way, another spoiler alert for Murder in Season. We get to see Mort Metzger's red Eldorado Cadillac convertible. I'm bringing that out of retirement, too. So a lot
that
to look forward to in Murder in Season. And then we got Caitlin coming in July before then in Strong from the Heart,
which
you're reading right now.
This is going to be so good. So where can you find everything? Where can we find out more about you and your work? And I think that Jessica should go up against Monk too, because I love Henry. I love Tony Shalhoub.
That would be a great pairing. Great pairing.
Yeah, I know.
I tell people, if you want to know specifically about the book, Google the reviews. Go to Amazon, see what people are saying on Goodreads. You know,
better yet, read
about
my review.
Me.
It's better than everybody.
Go to johnlandbooks.com, but there's not a lot there. People on their websites only put things there they want you to see. So if you want an objective opinion about whether you should read an author, you know, look them up on Amazon. Look her up on Amazon. Do some Googling. Go to my Amazon author page. You know, go to any – Google me. Ignore the police reports.
That's
move
true.
On to the book stuff.
And seriously, go on Just Reviews. That's my review site. I just posted the
review. There you go.
Actually, what's really hilarious is that the minute I post a review, everybody reads it. I have no idea why, but they do. They've been reading a lot. I mean, I just put something on Facebook the other day, and they go like, why are you reading that? Okay. They do. People read whatever I write, and which is really good.
Thank God.
Thank God is right. And I've been supporting local businesses in my neighborhood, and I've been supporting them on Facebook, and everybody's trying to go there. And I promised a shout out to Felix and Lisa of Arthur Avenue Pizza and Pasta in Hartsville. They make the best pizza in the whole world, and they love me. And they called me when they were closed for a month. I had a fit. And I said, it's about time you came back. They said, don't worry, we got a Sicilian on the house for you, because I did that. And it's the best pizza in the whole universe. So too bad you don't live in Hartsdale. What can I say? But thank you. Thank you so much. It should be interesting for Thursday, five people, the panel show. And they're going to do one on voice in June. It should be hilarious. I don't know. We'll find. But anyway, I'm looking forward to Caitlin. I should have that done by next week and send you the questions. No problem. I know it's August, but I've got a pile that's staring at me. But anyway, everybody have a nice day, Joan. Stay safe, please. And everybody have a great day, and bye.